Good afternoon. You're listening to Gambling with an Edge. Now here are your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is sports bettor, worked for Sportsbook, done a lot of games. His name's Elihu. Elihu, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks.
How did you get started in gambling?
A long time ago, I used to play a lot of board games. I still play board games. But board games are a form of gambling. And everything from Axis and Allies, which is a relatively easy board game, to A World at War, which is a grand, epic war game that takes 60 hours to play. And they all involve dice and probabilities and thinking ahead about problems. But if you mean, where did I actually risk my first dollar, that would be in blackjack in 2000 or 2001.
And how seriously did you, were you trying to make a living at it, or it just was a recreational thing for you at the time?
Well, how do you draw the line between the two? So I did it with the intent to win. So the first book I read on it was Blackjack for Blood, which, you know, don't start with high-low, start with the AO2 ace side count system. It didn't even occur to me that there were easier systems that would be better. And so, I wasn't sure it would work. A friend of mine from law school told me to try it, you know, because he said he makes lots of money, and I didn't believe it. Read the book. I wrote a computer simulator to, you know, play a million hands and see what kind of returns you could get and how different rules would change it. And it looked like you could actually make money at it. So I started playing it. You know, I started with $5,000 bankroll, except that I didn't quite understand bankrolls. I didn't quite understand variance or risk. I did everything possible wrong on, you know, low stake gambling venture. So, but I ended up winning still somehow. But I learned so much about general gambling theory from the misplaying of blackjack.
So it sounds like you were, prior to going to law school, your degree was in math or computer science, or?
Yeah, I studied math and computer engineering.
Okay, so then it seems like you didn't want to practice law.
Well, I didn't mind law. I enjoyed law. I liked jury trials. I'm a somewhat competitive person. And, you know, when you're litigating a case, it's a form of warfare. Now, the outcomes are mostly predetermined, but when the stakes escalate, the skill actually becomes relevant. And it was fun. Jury trials are fun. But when I got out of law school, I owed $100,000 from student loans. 5 years later, I still owed almost $100,000. So, I was living in a grungy, inexpensive apartment in a bad part of town, wearing cheap suits and driving a beat-up Dodge Shadow, because I was broke as broke can be, and I'm working full-time. And it seemed like, well, maybe I can find a different, maybe there's a better way. So
this sounds like you better call Saul.
Yeah, well, I'm specializing in injuries that were difficult to disprove. My my first boss went to jail for embezzling money from his clients, so.
Wow. So you then transitioned from blackjack into betting sports. How did that happen?
A friend of mine at Notre Dame, he said, why are you wasting your time on blackjack? You can make a lot more money in sports betting. And I didn't initially believe him, but, he showed me the math, and he did. And it turned out he had a approach. Now, again, there were all kinds of things I didn't know and I wish I knew back then. But we stumbled forward and somehow managed to make money using Sagarin ratings and NFL betting on full game spreads, which is probably the dumbest thing we could do starting out, but we didn't know better.
Well, also, what year was this?
This was 2001.
So this was also sort of the glory days of internet casinos, where they were giving away money like crazy. Did you discover that?
Yes. NetTeller, it was crazy how much bonusing you could get. But to me, that wasn't interesting. Now, in hindsight, that's clearly the best, free money, easy money, no risk money. That's the way to do it. But that's not sexy. You're not beating the man by abusing bonuses. This had to be mental warfare. Our minds versus theirs. And we had to come out on top. So Yes, it was in the heyday, and I completely missed it. I missed the easy money because I wasn't thinking in terms of executing a plan to make money. I was just trying to be a sports bettor.
So you started winning, but you're still practicing law at that point? Or at some point you started making more money betting than...
So 2001 through 2004, I kept doing both. Sports betting, blackjack, and law. Around 2004, I stopped practicing law because it was the time was it was costing me money to practice law. So,
and that's about the point you went to work for Pinnacle, right?
Right.
Now, how did that happen?
There was a sports bettor named Fezzik who had consulted for them in the past, and he recommended I contact Henry, who was kind of the head operations guy. About arena football, because I was doing well in arena football. So they brought me out to the island of Curaçao. If you've ever been to Curaçao, there's always this crud everywhere. They have oil refineries, so there's always going to be a coating of yuck. I didn't like the island, so the work was kind of interesting, a little stressful, but the island experience was very negative for me. So I didn't stay there very long. Less than a year.
But you mentioned before we started that your desk was next to Stan Thompson. So
they had me in training, learning how to trade. I got to watch Stan, listen to his commentary on baseball, and it was fascinating. He has just a whole different perspective. I mean, things that he thinks about that I would never think about. Everything for me is quant in out. And he's thinking about how much more money is left out there and who, this person has placed this bet, but who is this person really? It's not, so there's a lot more going on than just, sharp bets, dumb bets, and how much volume. He had almost a knack to tell how much money was going to come later. He'd always offer, big dog prices on the opener because he always wanted to get dog money early. Because, you're always going to get the favorite money, so offer a big dog price. And he did a lot of things that I had trouble understanding because it didn't fit nicely into a math model. But in hindsight, I can look back and say, that he knew a lot more than I ever knew about trading.
Yeah, he talked about that in my book. He talked about he called it reading the lines.
Yeah.
And that was one of the regrets I had about the book was, he couldn't talk about Pinnacle because he was – still heavily
litigation.
Involved and living in California, and it wouldn't, that wouldn't go down well. He was an interesting guy.
I read your book a few years later, and I was like, oh, Stan Thompson, I know him. I didn't realize he was a epic backgammon player when I was there. So I never, I played tennis with him, but I never played backgammon with him.
Well, were you even a backgammon player at that point in your life?
I first learned backgammon in 94. I had never played for money until I was in Curaçao. There was a bad gambler there who I played and beat him until he stopped paying me. And then I didn't play for money again until about 6 or 7 years ago.
So how long did you work for Pinnacle? And what did you do after you left Pinnacle?
I was physically on the island for about a year doing, trading and analysis. For 3 years after that, I wrote the Pinnacle Pulse, which was a weekly periodical they did teaching gamblers how to gamble better. It was, it was a form of free advertising in that they didn't have to pay to distribute it because you put out good content and people will watch it or listen to it. And I'm sorry, what was your question after that?
Where did you go next?
Well, also, I don't want to leave there quite yet. When you say, first of all, were you betting at the same time while you were working there? Because I would think that it'd be really informative to have the Pinnacle line before anybody else and bet other places. Or is that considered not kosher?
I was allowed to bet. So this is actually something we discuss. I discussed this with them, and I also discussed it with anyone I do consulting for. Am I, what are the terms for me being allowed to bet? And the general rule is you can bet anything you want unless you're managing it. If you're managing it, obviously you can't bet it. If you want it, I mean, you can bet it somewhere else, but just not there.
So, and also, I just, for our listeners that are not real sports bettors, when you talk about trading, does that mean you are the person moving the line on that particular whatever it is that you're trading? Or
yeah, just like a market maker in the stock market. You're trying to figure out who wants to buy what at what price, and you're trying to come up with the right price to, you know, so you can increase your spread or lower the spread to get money on each side. You can also change the price to buy, the money line. And you tweak these prices with two goals in mind. Usually you don't want to have a big lopsided position. So I don't want to be in a position where I win $1 million or lose 800,000. You know, flatter is generally better. But the other position, the other aspect is you don't mind having money on the right side. So for example, if I know that these five smart people like the Pistons tonight, and the rest of the world likes the public, likes the opposite side, you don't mind taking a big position when your position agrees with the smart people. So those are the two things you're kind of juggling when you're trading.
And how do they separate that out? Do they say, okay, you're going to be in charge of baseball today and somebody else is in charge of soccer? Or how does that work?
Usually a trader deals the same markets over and over. So, for example, you may have one soccer trader who's going to trade the pregame, that is before the match starts. You bet, you know, the full game spreads and totals, money lines, and maybe first half spreads, totals, and money lines. You might have a different trader who's trading the same games, but he's betting on how many yellow cards will there be, or how many, you know, all the obscure markets. So you carve it up into different niches, and each trader normally will handle the same thing over and over. And you may have a trader who handles more than one sport, you know, so basketball, college basketball will go through March. And then what's he going to do from April to October? He's got to do something. So you may have more than one sport, but generally whatever you do, you're going to do every day.
I got it. So I've talked many times on the show about having worked as a blackjack dealer and a boss, I've found tremendously valuable when I then was a player. I'm assuming working in a sports book, especially the premier sports book, would be really valuable to you as a bettor. Is that true? And how did that work?
Yeah, it's the things I learned were extremely valuable. There, so Henry taught me about respecting the line and fearing the market. And people who do not understand that concept are going to have a real big problem winning long term. You know, generally, the market is always right. The bigger the market is, the more accurate it's going to be. And understanding that can help you steer clear from horrific mistakes like trying to bet NFL spreads as your first plus EV play. Now, there's another set of information you can use from the sports books. That is, you can look and see which players are betting what. So if I'm, you know, hypothetically, if I'm trading baseball, I can say, oh, look, these smart people are here. And that gives me information that I could use to bet out, but that would create a conflict of interest. It's not okay to use insider information to bet outside, because that can change the market and affect your company's own profitability.
Huh. And now at Pinnacle, they didn't throw anybody out, right? So,
right.
But I mean, guys didn't come. Billy Walters doesn't come to Pinnacle and say, "I'm signing up my account. I'm Billy Walters." So now you know he's a smart guy. How do you deal with identifying that? And what about when they start fainting in the wrong direction?
And this is actually what a vast majority of my current consulting is doing. The goal is to rate how likely each wager is to beat you going forward. So, you know, the metric that most sports books use, especially the US-based ones, they're all going to look at your win-loss. You know, how much have you bet? What's your hold? How much money are you making? A lot of books will also look at something called closing line value. Closing line value is if you assume that the last bet place, whatever the last price was, is the correct price. How good does your bet look compared to that? So, for example, if I bet a game at even money, $100 to win $100, and 3 hours later, right before the game started, it closed at minus 120, $120 to win 100. That price I got earlier is a fantastic price. I look smart. I bought it for $20 less. That I paid $20 less for that wager than I would have if I bet it later. And that bet would be flagged as smart. If just the opposite happened, I bet $120 to win 100, and an hour, 2 hours before the match starts, that $120 to win 100 is now priced at $100 to win 100. That is a terrible bet. Now, most people can't lose that badly consistently, except for the manipulators you were talking about earlier. If a person is often getting horrific values, more than they should, there's a risk that they're a manipulator. But so that's one metric to use, is how much line value are they getting? Now, which works great until you start dealing with very complex manipulators or people who are working very hard not to move the line. So there's a whole different, when you're just like there's different levels of advantage play in blackjack or other sports. The one level of advantage play in sports betting is just I'm going to make good bets and win. But if you want to go to the much more strategic level where you're trying to hit home runs instead of, small ball, or you want to make a lot of money, then you want to ensure that your bets aren't moving the line. And that takes a lot more skill. It's very easy to win. It's much more harder to win and not move the line.
My one of the things I say probably most often on this show is it's easy to learn how to get an edge. It's hard to learn how to make money with it.
Yeah.
They're two completely separate skills.
Yeah. And in sports betting, it's very easy to make a little bit of money. But the question is, how do you make a lot of money? And that's the ongoing challenge. And because sportsbooks don't want people to beat them out of a lot of money, they spend a lot of money on analysis, on player profiling, finding ways so that they can take big bets and not have smart people scorch them.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, if everyone knows that the, I guess they're called retail books, just take their line from Pinnacle, mm-hmm. Well, then that's the last place a sharp sports bettor is going to want to move the line, right? They're going to want to bet there last.
Yes and no. In 2008 or 2007, there was a big change up in the betting market. The U.S. passed the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, and Pinnacle dropped out of the U.S. market. And shortly thereafter, they cut their limits drastically for U.S. sports. But the whole world was still copying them. So I think at one point, their second half college basketball spreads and totals, they were taking $100 or $200 when they used to be taking several thousand. But the rest of the world was still taking large bets and copying the smaller market. So you can only guess what happened at that point.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
So anytime I like a side, I'm going to fire off a couple $100 bets at Pinnacle, move the line, watch the market move, and then fire back at the rest of the market. And you still have this happening sometimes. People still use Pinnacle and some other books to manipulate. There are, for U.S. sports, good books to manipulate. If you're trying to shift the line, you can bet a lot more. If you move Bookmaker, if you move Bet Online, you move Pinnacle, you're going to shift the market. Now, not everyone shifts, but most of them will kind of follow blindly if you nudge those. So when you're manipulating, the question is, how much does it cost me to move the line, and how much can I bet back on the other side? So if I want to say I have to bet 15,000 to move the line at these three books 10 cents, I tied up 15 grand in capital, but as long as I bet it back the other way, I'm only paying $750, my 5% vig. So if I'm going to blowtorch $750 to get 10 cents the best of it, as long as I'm betting, at least 15,000 the other way, I'm going to at least break even on the gamble. But if some of these guys want to bet 100,000, then they're just tacking on extra profit by manipulating.
It also seems really dangerous to me. A lot of kind of the very first rung of the ladder for sports bettors is what they call top down, where you're basically just watching the line move and trying to jump on it.
Yeah.
But if guys are manipulating the line, you can get faked out and yes. be betting the wrong side and have the worst of it.
You could be. Now, I don't do top down. I don't do bottom up.
Yeah.
I don't do any of these, mainly right now I do derivatives betting, and I want as little line movement as possible.
So explain that for our audience. What is derivatives betting?
A derivatives betting is if you know what the correct price is for the spread and total for a game, then there are other markets that you can price that are a function of that. For example, if the Cowboys are a 7-point favorite in a football game and the total is 48, the first half spread should probably be pretty close to 4 or 4.5. And I have a program that prices this. So in any market, and the smaller ones typically you'll find more value, you determine what the correct derivative price is, and then you look for the derivatives that are mispriced.
So also in that same example, if the Cowboys are +7, you could also bet it, I want 8, I want 9, I want 10, and they give you a price for every single one of those, or 7.5, 8.5.
Yes.
And the other way too, 6.5, 5.5.
Those are called alternates, and those are often horrifically mispriced as well. So especially books that will move, let you sell 5 or 6 or 8 points, buy or sell 6. If a college basketball total is 130 and you have the choice to buy, I can bet under or over 140 or 120. So letting you buy or sell a full 10 points. It's very common to see mistakes in pricing that are going to give me 5 or 6% EV on this. The problem is these books that make these same mistakes, like DraftKings, tend to kick you out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So at one point, you called yourself Justin Seven, and you worked for Sportsbook Review. What was that all about?
Sportsbook Review was a gambling forum. I guess it's still up now. But one of the main roles they had was to look at the internet sports books, evaluate them, say how safe your money is at these different places, and help resolve disputes. So there are lots of times a player in a sports book will have a disagreement on something. I had one myself in Las Vegas 13 years ago when I bet that there will be no 2-point conversion attempt, and there was a muffed kick attempt. And the play-by-play said the kick attempt was aborted. Is that a 2-point attempt? So sometimes you have weird things that no one expects. And when that happens, that's actually where being a lawyer helps. You look at the rules, you look at the league rules, and you try to find the best answer. You make a recommendation, and most of the time the parties would abide by that.
Well, but with these online books, sometimes the rules basically say we can just take your money anytime we want if we think we don't, like what you did. Or, I guess the more reputable books try not to do that stuff. But boy, a lot of it comes up all the time still. I mean.
Yes, most books care about their reputation. If a book has a reputation for taking money unfairly from a player, people will stop playing there. There's a trade-off. Some books will offer lucrative bonuses, a sign-up bonus. But generally, the more reliable a sportsbook is, the less aggressive it has to be on bonusing. If you're going to get paid, there's nothing more important than that. Nothing else matters as much as a certainty that your money is good there.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you mentioned that there's a book right now that apparently there's a big nitrogen something? Nitrogen?
Yeah. Nitrogen Sports is historically had been a pretty good book. They're a Bitcoin-only book. So you send Bitcoin, you bet, you win or lose, you withdraw in Bitcoin. And they've been in business, I'm going to guess, 8 or 10 years. And a partner of mine was playing there. And we won 30,000. I guess 40,000, we got all but 10 of it out. And they just said, nope, we're not going to pay you the last 10 because you broke our rules. And the rule that we allegedly broke was we were playing from a banned jurisdiction. What is a banned jurisdiction? Well, if you look at their website, it doesn't say. It just says you promise it's legal to play wherever you are. So their rule means that my partner was playing in Costa Rica, but it's also not legal in the U.S. to play there. You know, it's so if you technically by the rules, anyone who plays in the U.S., they can confiscate their account. So if you, it's a little frustrating. So it's a different Nitrogen Sports than what I had expected, because in the past they've been pretty reliable. Huh. So, but when you have the sports books that start using, I'm going to call Mickey Mouse rules to steal from players, in almost every time that happens, it starts a downward spiral. You know, if you remember how many books have gone out of business, a lot of them start by doing stuff like this before they actually stop paying.
Yeah. Yep.
What did you personally learn when you were doing the moderation at this at Sportsbook Review that you found useful in your betting career?
Well, there's two different things. The most interesting stuff I learned was all the fraud. The crazy amounts of things people would do to steal money from sportsbooks. So 90% of the disputes I looked at involve someone trying to cheat a sportsbook. So
when you say cheat, you don't mean multi-accounting. You don't consider that cheating. What?
If I create two accounts at the same sportsbook, and that's cheating. You know, that's one rule that's fair. You can't create two accounts to collect two bonuses. And when you do that, bad things are going to happen. And that's a consistent rule everywhere in the world. And 90% of the cases I investigated involved players opening up multiple accounts, sometimes hundreds of accounts at the same sportsbook just to get bonuses. So there are a lot of bonus abuse rings that are, you know, or especially it used to be a lot of them were in Ukraine. There was organized groups. You have one group that would manufacture passports, another one that would manufacture IP addresses, it was savage. But they're
not doing that so much at the moment.
No, they're not.
Not in Ukraine, but the sports books have done things like, I mean, there was one place that wanted you to take a video with your phone and like scan around your head so that they could see that it was an actual person and not just a photograph of a.
Why do you think they do that?
Well, because people use photographs of.
Yeah. So if I'm investigating a claim and a sports book believes that you are not real, that this is a fabricated passport and you are not who you say you are, one way I could resolve that would be to do a Skype interview. All right, Skype, show me your passport next to your face. Yep. Show me your computer, turn around. Okay, you know, either you can or you can't. And every time you ask someone to do that, they're not going to be able to. So that, you know, case proven, closed.
Yeah. What about a mispriced game?
The bad lines, and this happens a fair amount. This is a little bit more of a gray area. If a sports book has a typo, there's different degrees of a bad line. Let's say Ohio State is a 40-point favorite versus Northern Illinois. And rather than say Ohio State minus 40, they say Ohio State plus 40.
Oh, I could beat that game.
Yes. Yeah, so that's like 100% mistake. If you have a monster error like that, it's clearly a bad line. The player should know better than to bet it. And you should know that when you do bet it, maybe you'll get away with it, but you're going to have a headache and maybe you're going to have it voided. The ones that are closer are when you have about a 10% difference in the market price. So a 10%, let's say if the fair price is plus $125, $100, pays $125, and they're paying plus 125, and it should be minus 125. So it's 125. It should be 125 to win 100. They're paying, you know, betting 100 to pay 125. So that's roughly 55 versus 45% break even. You know, it's roughly a 10% error in the probability, and that's about the range where most of the time I'm going to say it's a bad line. If the fair price is even money and they're paying plus 110, that's not a bad line. There's no clear rule, but the 10% rule is about what I recommend people use.
All right. We're going to ask some more questions when we get back. Right now, we're going to take a commercial break. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning at least 99%. This is more such games than anyone else has. The May promotion is half price gas and goods. For every $8,334 you earn and redeem in May, normally worth $25 in cash free player spending at various hotel and casino outlets, you'll get a $50 Walmart or Chevron gift card. You may earn up to 10 of these cards in May in any combination. Note that you do not keep your points when you redeem for the gift cards. Still, assuming you value the gift cards the same as cash, it's effectively a 0.6% slot club for the first $83,000 you play in May. On Monday, May 30th, 8 a.m. to midnight, there's a $32,000 hot seat promotion where every 3 minutes, one lucky player with card inserted receives $100 in free play. It's not worth a lot, but it's worth something. And if you still have part of your $83,000 for the gift cards to earn, it's a form of double dipping.
If you're serious about card counting, the Blackjack Apprenticeship membership is a great way to learn, train, network, and get the resources you need to succeed. We've had quite a few guests on Gambling with an Edge who exclusively trained and got their start through Blackjack Apprenticeship. You can check out their website at blackjackapprenticeship.com. They have member forums, training software, and guides to help you learn. So that's blackjackapprenticeship.com, and you will find a link to them in our show notes.
VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker Deluxe. This is a game where you pay an extra 5 coins per game, meaning triple play costs 20 coins, 5 play costs 30 coins, 10 play costs 55, and the bonuses come on dealt trips, full houses, and quads. Slightly different for Deuces Wild variation. If you get one of these bonuses, you spin the wheel. When the wheel spins, it lands on a drawing opportunity. Sometimes it's 100 play, 4 to a flush. Sometimes it's 10 play with a pair of aces. Sometimes it's triple play, 4 to a royal, etc. There's no skill involved in the hold for the bonus, and the bonus is earned on the draw, meaning that if you know the strategy for the base game, you know the strategy for the Wheel Poker Deluxe version. So that adds a bit of EV to the and a whole lot of variance. Surprisingly, the triple play version always pays a bit more than the 5-play version. For example, 9-6 double-double bonus, the base game pays 98.98%. The 5-play version on Wheel Poker Deluxe pays 99.31, and the triple play version pays 99.47. All right, we're back with Elihu. Now, we were talking about sportsbook review, and you were arbitrating. But sometimes you must have learned things during that process which helped you later as a sports bettor.
Yes. I saw a lot of clever players. When a player would find a way to beat a sportsbook that they hadn't seen before, sometimes a sportsbook would throw their hands up and just refuse to pay them. And then they would come in, and I would look at the dispute and see, you know, what was going on. And I remember there was a bizarre dispute with 5 dimes where a player had figured out a correlation that they didn't realize. You know, there's lots of different correlations that sportsbooks either ignore or are unaware of. But this player had figured out a really clever one in NBA where he was able to bet a lot of money. And, you know, does a sportsbook owe money when you make a correlated parlay? The answer is yes. Their software lets you do it. They owe it. The only exception is if it's 100% correlation. So a correlation, I don't know how, is when one outcome is related to another on a bet, on a parlay. If an example of one that is 100% correlated would be if I'm going to bet the Dallas Cowboys -3, and I'm going to parlay that with the Cowboys money line of -150. If the Cowboys cover the -3, they won the game. So that would be one of the few kinds of parlays that they could actually reduce, get rid of the, you know, one of the legs. They couldn't void it. They'd still have to pay you the -3, but they could void the leg of -150. But if they have Ohio State -40, and it lets you parlay that with over 45, there's a high correlation there. If Ohio State wins by 40, probably 95% of the time it's going to go over 45 points. So they're going to pay you 2.6 to 1 when the fair price should probably be about 0.95 to 1. So, but that's an example of a correlated parlay that if they took, they'd owe. So I saw a lot of unusual correlations, and I saw other things that they did. I saw fixed matches. I saw something. There's a technique called a key game parlay, where you have one play that's extremely strong. If it's going to be priced off by about 20%. So if the match is fixed, or if there's a massive injury that no one knows about, or if there's massive manipulation, how do you bet as much as you can on this one leg? And one way to do that is to parlay with lots of other things to get around their limits. So they're just, it was a lot of cool ideas that I was front row seat to.
Did you consider some of those gray areas or?
I made a judgment. I tried to do give recommendations that would be consistent with U.S. law if gambling were legal in the U.S. at that time. So in the case of, you know, if they, in most cases, if they offer it and it's not an obvious mistake, they're going to owe it. But on a key game, for example, where a person, they have limits of 1,000, but the person managed to bet 20,000 by parlaying it, the book software allowed it. So if they didn't want it, you know, ultimately the sports book is considered to be the expert in the field, more so than the player. So in general, unless it's something completely bogus, it's going to go in favor of the player over the sports book. Now, that's very different from how the U.S. does it. Every U.S. gaming commission I've dealt with has been savagely pro-sportsbook. There have been cases I would call slam dunks that shouldn't even be before a dispute board that I've had experiences with both Nevada and the Indiana gaming commissions where the outcomes are surprising. I don't want to say much more than that, but it's just I don't see how some of these resolutions can be justified.
So you mentioned, for example, Five Dimes. So you've done some consulting with them. Are you still able to bet into a book that you've done consulting for in the past? And
for the record, I didn't consult for Five Dimes.
Oh.
I consulted for Sportsbook Review, and they gave me a dispute between the player.
Oh, I see.
Five Dimes.
Yeah.
But yeah, if I'm allowed to bet at Pinnacle now, if I can do so legally. So it's not legal to bet in the U.S., you know,
yeah,
from the U.S. But I have a, you know, condo in Costa Rica that I'm at sometimes. I get excited sometimes.
Yeah.
All right. Since you're so excited, we're going to change subjects a little bit. Let's assume we're a sportsbook bettor and we're really concerned about account longevity. We don't want to get kicked out. Do you have any suggestions on how we can improve our chances of not getting kicked out?
The fastest way, there's two things that are going to get you kicked out or limited: winning a lot and having big line moves in your favor. Now, winning a lot, if I'm going to get kicked out, I want it to be for winning a lot. I don't want to get it to be kicked out for having good closing line value until I've won a lot. So the first thing is, if you have a way to bet without showing closing line value, that's going to help a lot. The second thing is, how can you bet with a behavior that will confuse the sports book so they think you're a moron? If they think you are a recreational idiot, you're going to last longer, even if you are up a lot of money. The most common thing I can say that'll help with that is betting parlays, which is the worst thing most bettors can do. And I can prove to you on paper that a three-team parlay is bad in almost every situation. There's only a handful of situations where people should be betting three-team parlays, and 99.99% of the parlays you see put into a sports book are not ones that they should be doing. So if you can find the situations where that's good, that'll help your account. Generally, I say never make bad plays to try to get longevity. Always make good plays, but if you can find a way to make a good play that looks bad, that's the ideal situation.
Now, if any of our listeners are thinking about starting betting on sports, or maybe they've been a long-term loser in the past and decided they're smarter now and they want to start winning at sports, What path should such a person take to become a winning bettor?
I would say the first thing they do is stop placing bets. Do not place a single bet until you can check off a list of things that you've done. You need to understand market efficiency, how betting markets work. A good book to get a big picture of that is The Logic of Sports Betting. At a minimum, you need to understand pre-algebra. If you can't do pre-algebra, and that is using Excel to solve equations, then there's no possible way you're going to win at sports betting long term. So if you can't do pre-algebra, get a book on pre-algebra. Do not place a single bet until you have grasp of pre-algebra. Now, a lot of people already have this. Once you've done that, then you need to understand two areas of math, Poisson distributions and discrete and combinatorial. So I would say spend some time, read, and learn about those. If you do all that, then you're ready to ask yourself one question before you place a bet. What is the fair price of this bet? So if you're saying, you know, you're looking at the Cowboys -3/110, the market is implied odds are 50% chance the Cowboys are going to cover -3. If you can't say the price should be 54 or 55% with some certainty, you're not ready to bet on that market. So in blackjack or backgammon, now maybe backgammon is not a good one, but in a lot of casino games, in video poker, you can figure out what your advantage is through simulations. You know, if you play perfectly, you have a pretty good estimate of what your EV is. Same thing in blackjack. If you play with perfect play, you can measure to within a tenth of a percent what your advantage is. In sports betting, if you want to have a chance to win long term, you must be able to evaluate your edge. And if you're placing a bet where you don't know your edge, you have no chance of winning long term. And most people make no attempt to figure out what their edge is.
Yeah, this is pretty shocking because we were all at Bet Bash a month ago or so. And I would say the majority of the people that I met in that room do not have the math skills that you're talking about. There was an awful lot of talk of this thing they call top down, which was something I had never heard of until Bet Bash, which basically sounds like chasing steam to me. And they seem to be making money. So is that just not a long-term solution? Or also, I think a lot of people there were just making money off bonuses too. But
there are lots of different ways to make money. The way I describe it is I'm going to call the frontal assault. The frontal assault is I'm going to generate plays with 4% edges for as long as I choose. And for the most part, I'm not going to get kicked out for it. Now, the top-down approach, steam chasing, as you describe, you can steam chase and make money not understanding it. It's going to help you to understand the math, but you can actually make small amounts of money steam chasing, or maybe more if you have the outs. As far as bonus worry, if you're going to do bonus chasing, you still need to do the math. You still need to understand what your edge is, or you're going to make mistakes and potentially make negative EV plays. There is a lot of risk management and a lot of fairly sophisticated math if you're going to optimize your strategies. An example would be if you have a free play. I have a free play. What is the best way to use that free play? And, you know, most good bonus players will tell you probably want to use a parlay in your free play. But what kind of bankroll do you need if you don't have positive EV plays to meet the rollover? Or if you still have to make some bets somehow with some disadvantage. So what are the bankroll requirements for whatever strategy? And most people have no clue. Most people start with how much can I get on the bonus? All right, here it is. Now what do I do? Whereas it should be the other way around. Here's my bankroll. How aggressively can I attack this bonus?
One of the things you didn't mention is your number of outs. Now, if you live in Vegas, there's all kinds of sports books. Well, not that many, but because they're all owned by the same people. And if you're in Colorado, you have a number of – but there are places – where players don't have a lot of outs. And if you're betting in one place only, no matter what your math skills are, it sounds like a tough road to me.
It's a lot tougher. And there are two things any player can do that any who bets a lot that are going to make him more money. He can get more outs. The more places you have to shop, the more often you're going to find a superior price. And that's going to help your long-term betting. The other thing you can do is you can bet less. So if you're betting enough where you have to bet at more than one place, if you know I have 20 outs, I'm going to take the best price at two of them. If I bet half as much, I just take the best price at each of the 20, at one of these 20 outs. I'll bet less, but I'm going to get on an average a better price. So if you eat less, you can often get a better price, a better average price. Now it may not be worth it. You know, some people have want just the opposite. I can take, do I want $1,000 at a 5% return, or do I want $20,000 at a 3%? I'll take, you know, 20 at 3. So it's different problems based on, I guess, your expertise.
So you're currently consulting for
a sports book.
A sports book that will remain unnamed. And before the show, you were telling Richard and me that at this particular sports book, if you want to be respected, you have to be a good backgammon player.
Yes.
So starting 6-7 years ago, you decided to become a really competent backgammon player.
Somewhat competent, yes.
And so apparently now you're at least halfway decent.
Yeah.
Now, how did you get halfway decent in backgammon quickly? I assume you spent a lot of time with XG, but I don't know that.
Yeah. So I had about 5 books. I bought another couple books, reread all the books, worked through all the problems, and then spent about half an hour a day on XG, in addition to playing people. And it got me to a reasonable level. You know, I wouldn't want to play a good player for money, but it's, you know, some businesses, they play golf when you network. You go out to the golf course, you talk business, and that's where all, you know, people go. In a lot of the sports books, instead of golf, it's backgammon. They'll play backgammon.
I wish I had known this a long time ago. Although I have to say, there were a lot of bookies that I played backgammon with back when I was a player.
Yeah. So I learned it in the hopes that it would make it easier for people to stomach my math, because sometimes the math, when you're doing analysis, tells them something very different from what they either think or want to believe. And if it's my hope was I'd get some credibility by being a competent blackjack player.
You know, it's kind of amazing that bookmakers have not kind of shifted over into being math guys. They're still sort of, I don't know. I mean, they're hiring math guys, but they just seem to be a bit behind the times.
A lot of the sports books are very math heavy. So I think that is the direction you have to go. It's funny. I think the U.S. sports books are spending a lot less on math than the offshore books. And this is why you see that the lines, for the most part, offshore are much sharper than the ones in the U.S.
Well, yeah, and the U.S., so many of the books are just, oh, if a guy wins, we'll just throw him out right away or limit him down to a $2 bet. So,
yeah, it's a different method, and it has its vulnerabilities that I would like people to use. We talk about flipping whales. If you find a player that's down a lot at a sports book and you're able to play, you know, somehow have a way to get bets into that account, not only can you know, continue betting, but you can often bet much higher limits because they have scale. Lots of sports books have scaling limits. So I remember when I was betting correlated parlays into Bovada, and at one point I was down 100,000. These things happen. You know, you go on losing, especially when you're betting long shots. You know, if you're betting a correlated parlay, that's the fair price is plus 400. It's not unusual to go through a 10 or 20 bet losing streak. It just happens. And suddenly you're down a lot. But the wonderful thing about, you know, you talk about account longevity. If you go through a losing streak, it's only a loan. It's not permanent because they're going to raise your limits and guaranteedly let you play until you win it back.
Well, although Bovada has been known to not pay people
Bovada's pretty good. I haven't seen a lot of – in fact, I don't remember seeing any blatant thefts. Hmm. I've seen some bonusing issues, you know, but I haven't – and I saw one issue where somebody did a key game parlay and got mugged. But it's...
Yeah, it seems to me if they're going to post a price... I mean, I understand if it's a mistake, right? Plus 40 instead of minus 40. But if they're going to put up the parlay and say, yes, you can bet this parlay, I sort of feel like they should have to eat that, yeah. Even if it's correlated. I mean, that's their job. That's
yeah. And for the most, they I beat them out of maybe – when I finished with Bovada, I was up maybe 200,000 from correlated parlays. And they paid me – they paid all of them with no problem. Clockwork. The one I saw that they didn't pay that surprised me. It was a key game parlay on a manipulated game. So maybe there was a player who should have been favored who ended up paying 4-1, and then the player sent 25,000 and bet it all in parlays on that one player. So it's a little shady, but I would have paid it. You know, if you don't have traders that can't, your traders should build a spot manipulation or at least identify the markets that can be manipulated, and then you choose not to let parlays on those.
So when you say manipulation, you're talking about a player that's been paid off or something?
That's one possibility also. There's not much difference between a manipulated match and a fixed match. A manipulate or even tanking. In a manipulated match, say the price starts off at even money, and I'm going to bet it a bunch of times at Pinnacle to drive tennis, drive up the price. I bet it, you know, 5-6 times, and against when you bet into openers, it's cheap to do it. The limits might only be $100. It might only cost me a couple thousand dollars to pump it up. Then the rest of the market copies, and you can then play at the incorrect, basically the incorrect price.
Oh, and so I see the distinction between manipulation and
That's a manipulated match. A fixed match is when a player before the match starts has decided to lose, and it's usually only one person deciding it. The winning player is always going to try to win. The losing player may have an investment, or for whatever reason, he's chosen to lose that. And I did a research paper on that maybe 8 years ago. I published it on ways to predict fixed tennis matches, and also another one on soccer. And it happened back then. It did happen quite a lot. That's to be contrasted with tanking. Sometimes a player is tired. You know, the ATP, WTA, they require their players to play 26, 28 matches a year. If you don't play the minimum number of tournaments, not matches, but tournaments, there are penalties. Your rankings don't go up as nicely. And I don't know all the things, but they're highly incentivized to play a certain number of matches a year. So sometimes, especially if they just won a final and they have to play a match the next day, sometimes they'll show up and go through the motions, but not really play all out. And I don't want to say they're not playing all out, but they're playing statistically less than you'd expect. At a level that's lower than you'd expect.
They just don't have any gas left.
Yeah. And there were also, I've seen some stuff where you have a player playing a match on Monday, and there's a tennis league. They have a team tennis match on Wednesday or Thursday. So there's no possible way he can play in the finals of that tournament, and then he loses. So players, you know, get information like this. Or what if a player out, you know, drunk 10 hours before his match, and you find out on Twitter? That's similar to an injury. Injury that the market doesn't know about. The market is inefficient for a while. For whatever reason, the price is incorrect and the players know. And sometimes it moves a lot. And if it's going to be a big movement, it's a key game and you're looking for ways to bet more.
And some places will refuse to pay those?
Most places pay those.
Okay. Yeah.
The one case I saw where Bovada didn't, it really surprised me. But then, like I said, I was recently surprised by Nitrogen Sports, who just didn't want to pay me on normal bets, my 4% frontal assault.
Well, and sometimes it's not always announced when a star player is going to be sitting out a game. Coach's decision or mental health day. And if you know that Steph Curry isn't going to play, and everybody else thinks he is, that would have an effect on the line.
Yeah, it would have a huge effect, and the market is extremely efficient. So if the market originally thinks he's playing and one syndicate knows he's not, they may bet enough to correct the market. So sometimes when you see a market moving and you don't know why, you don't immediately bet the other side because you think the market's wrong. you must be afraid of the market and know that it knows something you don't.
All right. We've been talking to Elihu. This has been fun. And hopefully you'll come back and talk to us again someday.
Sure. I appreciate you guys having me.
At the end of our shows, we frequently have a recommended section. Richard, do you have something to recommend to our audience today?
Yeah, my recommendation is a YouTube video. We had a card counter on the show named Stephen Bridges, who is chronicling his life as a card counter on YouTube. But this particular episode is from somebody he knows, and it is basically this guy getting stopped by the police in Colorado and being told that carding cards is illegal. And it's just mind-boggling. And, you know, when I try to tell this stuff to civilians, they're like, oh, that would never happen. You know, they can't do that. But this guy caught it all on video. And it's well worth watching just to see how really uninformed the police, and one of the guys is a gaming agent. I think the gaming agents are police in Colorado, but so they got this guy and then a regular police, and it's a crazy video. So we'll put a link to it in the show notes. It's one of Stephen Bridges, and it's called, the title of it is Police Detain Card Counter.
All right. Now, my recommendation is rather self-serving. On Saturday night, May 21st, I'm performing with a family-friendly improv comedy troupe here in Las Vegas. It'll set you back $10 if you wish to watch. It's nice to see friendly faces in the audience. Now, Richard is part of that same troupe, but this time he may have a conflict, and it's not guaranteed at all that he'll be at this performance. It's being held at the Grace Valley Church, which you can look up, and we'll post a link in the show notes. So, Elihu, do you have a recommendation for us?
Yes. When I was at the Bed Bash at Circa, I went to an awesome, relatively inexpensive restaurant, 8 East. It's an Asian restaurant, had lots of noodles, and they had this bowl that had this chili pepper in it that made your tongue go just a little bit numb. And it was an experience I'd never had, and it was delicious. So that's my recommendation. 8 East.
Yeah, I've had that same spice there on their green beans. I don't know what it is. I don't know if that's the particular dish or they have it on other dishes too. But it, first time I had it, it's like, I got something wrong here. And they go, oh, that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I had several. It was on several dishes.
And being a slow learner, I ordered again next time. All right. So thank you, Elihu. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.